Hey, what's up, Q? How's it going, man?
It's been a while. Yeah, we haven't spoken to each other in a long... I mean, we talk, you know, over DMs and text all the time, but
yeah.
I hadn't spoken to you on your podcast for a very long time.
There was a... People really enjoyed that one, by the way. The one where we were talking about this, the diaspora situation.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to get yelled at.
No, some guy, like, actually commented on SoundCloud, which is not typical for us to get comments there, and he was like, This conversation is incredible. <'Cause> I think whoever that was really enjoyed what the nature of the conversation. But it's been a while, and I usually there's a certain kind of like conversation that you get going with people when it's just mainly through tweets. And it's kind of funny. Because I feel like I get the feeling there's a lot of people, not a lot, but there's like a circle of people on Twitter that I don't actually message a lot. Like, there's people I never DM with them, like ever.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm talking to them on Twitter all the time. And I'm getting a sense, that there's an attitude in the air lately about this being,
and
I don't know if it's this is the year, but like some shit's going down.
It's a massive understatement. I think we're like headed for a societal level crash out, which frankly I think it's kind of needed. It's almost like this is gonna be a bit of a gross analogy, but you know when you know when you're like, you can feel a zit growing underneath your skin.
Yeah.
Like, it's like pressing on your nerves, and you just wish it would just fucking, like, erupt already. You know?
Yeah, like, get it over with.
Yeah, exactly. But it's more like a boil on society's ass or some shit like that. But, yeah, there's just a whole lot of tension. There's a whole lot of pressure that's being built up underneath, I think, the general body politic. And a couple of things are happening. One, none of us can fucking stand each other anymore. Like, I think we all kind of played nice since the Obama years, made a whole lot of coalitions.
You're talking about like as a country or as a civilization?
Here's the thing. I'm from Canada, right? So speaking as a bit of an outsider here, but I think Obama had a bit of a halo effect on at least on the Anglosphere, right? So Canada, the UK, Australia, even like the Caribbean, et cetera, there was a bit of a halo effect where all of us had the sense that we could actually put aside our differences and come together in support of who the fuck knows what, because there was really just all like empty platitudes at the time, which a lot of people did criticize him on. The problem is you can't fly on fumes forever. You have to have some sort of fuel, something to combust, something that's actually like driving our forward momentum. And we don't really have that. We just have an idea as to what kind of people we want to be and what kind of country we want to have. We just have no strategy to get there. And in the meantime, with the bottom basically falling out of the labor market, with over-financialization pretty much coming to an end, like we're almost out of racetrack where it comes to debt financing. I think we're just crashing into some very hard realities, which is, yeah, some of these motherfuckers got to go. Like, some of us are just not going to be able to work together, and that's fine.
Mm, yeah. I think so, too. I get this feeling that our economy is becoming one that, this is an idea that's been really, like, kind of stuck in my brain lately.
Yeah.
That we're becoming both an economy and a culture where we're really actually trying to identify losers.
More so like select losers.
That's exactly what I mean. But what I mean is that the point of it is to identify those that we like, some social consensus as to like who's going to be the losers here. And like, that's a big change, because like, even when people talk about capitalism these days, you know, like there's these like gung-ho pro-capitalist types who are like, you know, they have a Darwinian, there's a social Darwinian view where it's like the strong will survive and the weak. The whole point of capitalism is to weed out weakness so that, you know, the main body politic can stay strong. And I'm like, that was never what capitalism was supposed to be.
I think it began moving in that direction towards the end of the 19th century. Like, that's what the progressivist movement was about, was strengthening society by culling the weak. It's just that they culled the weak through American expansionism and eugenics.
But the when you go back to the shit, like, more recently, and I would say like late 20th century, the promise, I'm not saying that this was ever the case, okay? I'm just saying, at least at an ideological level, we all agreed. And I went back and I looked at this, and I would say that this is pretty true. That the promise was that free markets and moving away from the liberal welfare state, the reason we were going to do that is because it would lift all boats. That there really wouldn't be any losers. Like, everyone would be a net winner. Some would win more than others. But it was never like straight up, we got to kick people off the boat. And I feel like we're moving towards like the actuality, of course, is that we were kicking people off the boat this whole time. But at least in our minds, we were like, that's not supposed to be the point. And if that happens, unfortunate.
No, in a way, you're right. Yeah, I think, again, you know, with the financialist regime of the 1970s and 1980s, and basically like the hauling out of America's industrial sector, and this wasn't just America. I mean, this was, again, this was Canada, the UK, etc. You know, all Western countries were basically handing over the manufacturing.
Like Reagan, Thatcher, you think, like around that era,
Reagan, Thatcherism. Yeah. It's where the banks basically became like the power shifted from manufacturing to the banks, which was probably the biggest mistake that we've ever made. And with that comes this promise of endless boundless wealth. But at a point you realize that to continue with your ship analogy, this ship has sprung a leak and we have to jettison dead weight or we're all going to sink.
Yeah.
Like we have to establish what the dead weight is. And you see it in, for example, like, everyone's arguing about these DEI programs that are being cast aside. So the CIA recently closed up their DEI department. A lot of other larger companies are either massively downsizing or getting rid of their DEI employees, management, etc. But this has been actually happening since it began to happen in 2019. And then the 2020, the lockdowns, the BLM movement, the uprisings caused a resurgence in DEI hiring. They actually ended up turning that wagon around in order to save their PR. Google actually was one of the companies that had begun to jettison their DEI hires. When I say DEI hires, I don't mean hiring people to fulfill DEI mandates. I'm more talking about management level employees that would report directly to the VP of diversity, and the VP of diversity would report to the CEO. But those management and executive level employees were getting jettisoned. This was happening in 2019. This was after, do you remember James, I think his name is pronounced Damore?
Yeah, over at Google, right?
Google employee, he wrote a letter basically complaining about DEI. Yeah, and this was what, 2018, 2017 or 18?
That sounds about right. Yeah. That sounds about right.
Before
COVID.
Yes.
I feel like Me Too was still in the air and we had a lot of the...
So Me Too was around October 2017. So I guess this would have been like around spring to summer of 2018 where this whole thing went down.
Yeah.
But by 2019, this was happening in tech companies and it was happening in financial companies. And I know this because Royal Bank of Canada up here, Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, CIBC, like the big five banks were beginning to scale back their DEI efforts and the hires, et cetera. It was also happening in the tech sector as well. And 2020 caused a couple of things to happen. One, like everybody ends up having to work from home. And then because the infrastructure required to have everyone work from home meant that more developers, engineers, but also management level employees had to be hired in order to build that infrastructure, and both vertical and horizontal mergers and even monopolies were formed at that time. All of this required more employees to be taken on. And then 2022, when these companies realized that they've massively overhired, they just don't need these employees anymore. The infrastructure is built. All that's required is maintenance, or at least the base amount of maintenance required to keep their profits afloat. They begin jettisoning these employees again. These were always temporary hires. So the only way that could have happened is if you have massive amounts of cheap money available. And as we know, during and after COVID, there were large amounts of cheap money available. We were in a low interest rate environment, and these companies were getting massive government subsidies. Well, now we're in a high interest rate environment. Those subsidies are no longer available. So what do? They let those employees go. The problem is the left does not know how to identify this issue or talk about it in any meaningful way other than with identity-based platitudes. And because they don't understand economics, finance, etc., aside from what shows up in the headlines, they don't know how to connect these dots because they just don't understand these concepts.
Math is hard. Mm-hmm.
They talk about it in terms of the ruling class, or they'll start talking about it in terms of colonization, color, etc., but they're not actually speaking to the issue. The right wing, they're born and bred in these issues. They know how to talk about this stuff because their parents sat around watching Fox News all day, at the very least. They go to college, and they go to business school. They graduate out of STEM programs. They know how to talk about this shit. They'll be able to identify the problem, but their analysis obviously is wrong. But the thing is, if somebody's identifying the issue, it almost doesn't matter what their analysis is. At least someone has to be able to say, hey, let me explain to you how this shit is happening right now.
Yeah.
And that's what people are listening to. That is the basis of the economic anxiety argument, where people are saying that Americans are not economically anxious, they're just racist. And I'm like, no, they actually are. These are the only people that will explain this shit to them.
Regarding the left, right? I think I agree with you. What I see, I don't know if you agree with me, but like with a lot of like left analysis, so to speak, it's a lot of it is like plagued by a sort of like doomerism and straight up it's cynicism. I don't know if I'm going to go all the way to nihilism. I don't think it's quite nihilist, but
it is nihilist in a way.
It is in a way, but it's also just like it's a sort of like, don't give me the information because all of the information is poisoned. All I'm telling you is that it's like there's malevolent forces out there that are trying to, you know, do X or Y or Z. Like there's a certain like kind of dismissal of all information and practical realities as being part of an op, right? Like I get this a lot from people on the left, which is like, haha, you take that seriously, that's an op, right?
And I
feel like that's actually sort of like a weird left wing conspiracy QAnon thing.
The cargo cult of the PSYOP, which is basically when things happen that you can't explain, just chalk it up to a PSYOP and move on.
Like, how is that different than QAnon? I feel like there's a left QAnon thing going with that.
It's fundamentally the same impulse. That is complicated structural events can easily be hand waved away by saying it's somebody behind the scenes that is causing this to happen. Mm. The problem is, two things. The way that explanation comes about is by doing a couple of, you're engaging in the merging of opposites. On the one hand, the ruling class, they're stupid, they are bungling, they're just flying by the seat of their pants. But at the same time,
they've mismanaged everything. They can't handle.
They keep blowing it every single time. But at the same time, they are cold, calculating, cruel actors who will smile to your face and pretend to care about you. And at the same time, are working to undermine you.
Yeah.
So you know, Nancy Pelosi on the one hand, you know, kneeling in Capitol Hill, wearing a kufi and a kente cloth, along with the rest of the Democratic caucus. That's oafish, stupid, bad PR, so on and so on. These people are so dumb, aren't they? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, haha, what an idiot. She's so naive. She doesn't know what the fuck she's talking about. But at the same time, she is an undercover Fed. She's CIA. She wasn't a bartender. She's a plant. So it's like, okay, so which fucking one is it? And the problem is you can only carry that for so long before people start saying, okay, so all things being equal. So they're ruthlessly efficient, brilliant Machiavellian manipulators. And at the same time, they're a bunch of idiots. How do we fix anything? What do we do now? Wait for the revolution. What the fuck are you talking about? Go organize in your neighborhood. Go get your block organized. Organize your workplace. Well, if that would have worked at any point in American history, it already would have.
Also, that's what AOC was doing, to be honest. I mean, if we're honest about it, that's what these people were doing. They all started out as community level organizers, and then they became attached to the party through, let's say, an alternative apparatus like the DSA. Mm-hmm.
My question: organizing to do what? What do you mean? Like that's the question that I've always had when people talk about, like, you know, go out and organize to do what?
So I think what they actually mean is, and they won't admit it, but it's simply to participate in mainstream politics.
To get people together. Because really, when we talk about organizing in the U.S., it tends to be organizing for the purpose of funneling people into the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. That's pretty much what it is.
Yep.
So you can call it the Justice Democrats, you can call it whatever you want, but it's pretty much like creating an entryist pipeline to the Democratic Party. It's just coming in through a democratic socialist aesthetic. That's pretty much it.
I think it's herding people under a tent in which there is a common narrative within that tent.
Yeah.
And a leader is, a leadership is created that's trusted. And that leadership is attached to bigger, you know, apparatus of power, bigger institutions. Mm-hmm. And they become part of the whole system, which I don't think is necessarily inherently bad or wrong, but like I think that's what they mean, right? DSA is inherently part of the Democratic Party. I don't see it as anything independent.
It's a Democratic Party apparatus. And I wish they would be more honest about it.
It's the Tea Party of the left, right? I mean,
I don't even know if I would say that.
It's weaker tea than the Tea Party, you're saying?
The Tea Party at least had something resembling group discipline. The DSA doesn't have that.
They did. They took over the party. That's for damn sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they did take over the party, but how did they do that? I mean, you can talk about it being AstroTurf by the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, and yeah, sure, that's all true. But there was hierarchy, structure, and discipline.
Mm.
Which the DSA almost completely lacks. I'm not really sure how you can run a socialist organization that's also decentralized.
That's what makes it so successful, because I think the purpose of it is to sort of corral the left and make sure that they don't, despite, like, as an example, right?
You get them together under a, and it's not really a tent. It's almost like you're grouping them underneath like the most rickety lean-to that's ever been built.
Yeah,
there's nothing really grouping them all together, because as I mentioned, it's a decentralized organization. There's not a solid hierarchical structure. So at the same time, you're bringing them together under this socialist patina or whatever you want to call it. But because it's so decentralized, they cannot organize the groups effectively to do anything within the party.
Yeah.
And so that's basically the PSYOP, is giving people the impression that they are participating in socialist politics, while at the same time, you've, by the structure of the organization, it's neutralized itself.
Does critiquing it even matter, or should it just be ignored? I feel like it should just be ignored.
I think that if anybody right now is still talking about the DSA, it's one of two things. They're either boosting an organization that's pretty much dead in the water, or you're giving attention to an organization that's dead in the water. So yeah, you're right. I think they should just generally be ignored. If they start making noise, just be very cruel to them. Just be very mean and degrading and dehumanizing to them, and then just let it go. No, I'm serious. That's the only language they understand. That's the only thing that they understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like I got the feeling like that there were some people hardcore left but anti-Trump, the sort of like cynical anti-Trump view, where it's like, yeah, I hate Kamala, but you know, she's a genocider, but if you're a fool to think Trump is any better. He's a hardcore Zionist. He's even more hardcore Zionist than
Biden. Which was also silly.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like the fact that
Trump is not a hardcore anything. He's not a hardcore. You got to keep in mind, back around 2012. You know what people on the right were calling Donald Trump? Donald the Dimmy. Why? Because Dimmy.
Okay.
Dimmy is a if you live in a Muslim country like during the Ottoman Empire and you were a non-Muslim, you were not like a full citizen per se, right? You were basically like a guest, or you could almost say a second class citizen, but it wasn't really quite like that. But anyway, you were Dimmy. You weren't a full citizen. So that meant that you had to pay certain taxes, like jizya. And the way that that's been regurgitated through modern Islamophobic culture is that you're just like a cuck. You're a cultural cuck. So when he... Remember when he used to run the Miss Universe pageant?
Yeah.
So a contestant, and I forget which country it's from, but it basically I'm pretty sure she was Lebanese-American. Contestant ended up winning the pageant, and people got really upset at him because they're like, well, how could you let a Muslim woman win this pageant? And he's like, well, I mean, she's a beautiful girl. She, she's all American. She was born in America. She has American values. Like her very much. She's very pretty. And because he wasn't going to capitulate to everyone that was telling him that he should just snatch the crown away from her for being a Muslim, they called him Dimi. Mm. He also has real estate he's got real estate properties. I mean, all across the Middle East, right? But, I mean, wherever this guy shakes somebody's hand, a Trump hotel goes up. So he's not going to jeopardize his relationship with Middle Eastern countries just because a significant portion of his base doesn't like Muslim people. The guy's not a Zionist. He'll just make whatever deal redounds to his favor. He doesn't give a shit. He's not a true believer.
Yeah, well, he was able to deliver on a ceasefire before he even took fucking office. And
it probably won't last, but...
Well, okay, but it's something.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Drawback
in the slaughter compared to what we've been seeing the last 18 months.
Well, let's put it this way. I do believe that there were scenes of Gazans celebrating.
Yeah.
And Hamas wanted this deal for a long time, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. And
Israel...
had the deal last summer.
Yeah, that's the scary part of this that's coming out, and now there's more information coming out that, in fact, it was Biden/Blinken that was actually kind of tapping the brakes on this whole thing. Yep. And I got the feeling, honestly, that there were some people on the left who felt threatened by this. They felt threatened by the fact that Trump turned out to be more effective in being a peacemaker there than they believed that he would be able to. And they kind of were rooting for his failure, which to me is the ultimate cynicism, which means that your political identity is more important than the material fact of peace.
It's all a game of football. You know what's a really good example of that? Do you remember when he was able to push through prison reform? This was in 2020.
Yeah, that was a big deal. I mean, it was a very huge deal.
And people got really mad at the prison abolitionists, the legal reformers, everybody who was willing to work with him. They got so pissed off at him. Remember, he pardoned Santoya Brown. Do you remember that?
I kind of do.
Santoya Brown was a young black woman. I mean, I shouldn't say young woman because she was a child, basically, when she was trafficked into the sex trade.
Yeah.
And she was being raped by the clients that she was forced to have sex with, and she was being abused by her pimp. And one day, while she was being physically abused by her pimp, she was able to get her hands on a gun, and she shot and killed him. And she was in prison for it. And there was a huge movement. I mean, it's obviously an incredibly, like a huge miscarriage of justice to put this traumatized young woman in prison. And Kim Kardashian, of all people, was able to get a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office and convince him to pardon her. And he did. And yeah, so that was, I mean, this sort of it was a 1-2 punch.
That
was,
I remember people saying that it was a cynical media ploy. He didn't really care about the justice that's aspect of it. He was using it to further his brand and all this stuff. And I'm like, but who do you think she cares?
Everybody that worked on that, everybody that worked their asses off to make that happen. I mean, did you get Santoya Brown out of prison? Just shut the fuck up.
What's her thoughts on it? You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know if she's actually said anything. I mean, as far as I know.
Yeah, but it's just like, okay, so you're sitting here saying that. Oh, you're stupid for believing that Trump is sincere about this or whatever. I'm like,
none of us think that.
Are you a fucking Hamas negotiator? You know what I mean? Like, why don't you? Do you have a contact over at the Hamas leadership, and you could tell them maybe you shouldn't take the deal because Trump isn't genuine and you know better?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, man. Fucking done with the left, to be honest. Like the concept of it.
I'm sorry, like. I don't like to put the left into one big basket because a lot of us should not be working together. But, you know, people who consider themselves to be on the political left in the West generally are just the worst crybullies. On the one hand, they've defeated themselves before they've even begun because they believe that with all the powers of capital aligned against them, how can they win?
Yeah.
And on the other hand, they get really upset when people try to score whatever small victories they can, because how could you? You're giving more ammunition to the right. And it's like, sorry, for people that believe, I mean, not believe in, it's not a matter of believing, it's a thing that's true, thing that exists. For people that acknowledge that that society accords itself to whatever material conditions are thrust upon it, then how can you get upset at people for improving themselves or improving conditions for themselves, going from being in prison to out of prison, going from having the full weight of the IDF cast down upon you to negotiating a ceasefire. And you're upset about it because a person that you don't like is going to get credit for it. It's absolute bullshit. Nobody should ever listen to these people. And I don't like to consider myself an accelerationist, but hey, maybe Curtis Yarvin made some points here, which is you strip away the polite artifice of liberal society, and you get down to the mud, the muck underneath it, the fundament, which is, I mean, capitalism itself, which, as you were saying before, isn't supposed to act like it picks winners and losers, but fundamentally, it really does. If you strip away that polite artifice and start dealing with capitalism as it is, that's what you find yourself doing. Negotiating with fascists. Because what is the Democratic Party? What are progressive liberals but polite middlemen that shield you from that muck? You know, that stop you from getting your hands dirty. So yeah, I'm kinda glad that the Democratic Party has all but collapsed at this point. Their approval rating, the last I saw, was at 33%, which is that was the same approval rating that George Bush had. That is the average of his polls upon leaving office was 33%. And I remember at the time when people were asking, like, how does he even have 33%? What the fuck? Because keep in mind, like, we were still in the middle of the 2008 financial crisis when his term ended. And yeah, when people would ask, like, how the hell could he have a 33% approval rating? Like, don't they know how much he's fucked this country up? The answer to that was, well, hey, you know what? I guess a third of the country are just too stupid to function. Like, they just can't be saved. They can't be spoken to. A third of the electorate is just, they're just fucking idiots. So don't even worry about it. Let's focus on the ones that can be reached, that can be helped. So then what do you say about the Democratic Party in this instance? Same number.
Yeah. I don't think they matter. I suspect that they're going to be playing catch up for a while.
They shouldn't be. What should actually happen? People should actually work to just absolutely destroy any possibility of that party participating in further elections. It has to be torn apart, and an actual labor party in America, it has to be built out of its ashes. Like, it needs to go the way of the Whig Party.
I believe that actually we need a four-party system. Let me explain. I think that what we saw with that whole Vivek shit and the H-1B and how and how MAGA base went after their fucking people. Like, they went after Trump. They went after Vivek. It got ugly. It was a rough day for Indians online. I'm not going to lie. It was rough.
It's been a rough couple of years for Indians. They've been catching the wildest strays.
They've been catching strays. It's true. But Vivek is their man. Okay, so...
Yeah.
Is
he, though? He kind of isn't. It depends on which...
Kind of isn't, kind of isn't. But what I'm saying is... What I'm saying is that the MAGA base went after Vivek. They went after Elon. And then when Trump said he actually backed Elon on the H-1B, they went after Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And the people on the left largely just sat back and laughed as this sort of like crack appeared in the Trump coalition.
Yeah.
And I thought, why are you laughing? Because this is a legitimate labor debate. This is a legitimate labor versus capital.
Do you know how many arguments I've gotten in with people? No, I'm not just like, I argue on Twitter all the time. Mm-hmm. Right? And the problem is, because, you know, I've been recovering from a serious injury for the last few months. I find myself with an abundance of time to do that. Probably not the healthiest thing. But got into arguments, like, with, you know, friends and family over the same thing. Who, when I say it, they say, well, you know who agrees with you, right? And of course, it's the right wing. But I'm like, no, but here's the thing. It's an actual labor issue. Because what do you say to somebody who, keep in mind, for guys like us who are, I'm not sure what exact year that you were born, but you're, I'm guessing, in the millennial bracket, right?
No, I'm late Gen X.
Oh, Gen X? Okay. Mm. So, oh, you're older than me. Holy shit. All right.
Yeah, I'm 1978.
Hey, you're holding it together, man.
Mm.
For people in our age bracket, you know the story that you were told growing up. That is, go to school, get good grades, go to college, you'll get a good job, you know, build a family, buy a home, yada, yada, yada. Like, you know exactly how that timeline is supposed to work out. That chronology doesn't work anymore. Because back then, back in the 90s and 2000s, our competition in the job market was with each other, like people that were working domestically.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
Now our competition is global. Yeah. So a job posting goes up, and back then, like, we didn't have job postings because we didn't have the internet. You had to know somebody inside of a company. Yep. Occasionally, you had the Horatio Alger approach, where you would go to the company or you'd go to the head office and try to talk to somebody or put in your resume or whatever with your briefcase in hand, ask them for a job, and they might give you one. That actually did happen.
Yeah.
But it mostly came through networks, whether it was people that you met in college and could put you in touch with somebody who could put you in touch with somebody, or you had family connections, or you just got noticed because you got really good grades. That doesn't really fly anymore. Now a job posting goes up on a company's website, or it shows up on LinkedIn or whichever job board that you use. And everybody in the world sees it. And everybody in the world is competing for that job. Do you know how fucking demoralizing that is?
Yeah,
to put out resume after resume after resume after resume. Write 40, 50 different versions of the same fucking cover letter.
Yeah.
And never get a call back because everybody in the world is applying for the same job you were.
Dude, I was electrical engineering undergrad.
Mm.
And I got a taste of this, right? So my third year, somewhere around there, okay, like, I'm already into like some of the more intermediate levels of EE, where I'm working on, like, I was doing signals processing and mm-hmm. you know, shit like MP3 and audio compression, video compression, that kind of thing, right? It was gonna be a big thing. It is still a big thing. Yeah. So I spent a summer
there's still a pretty solid demand for sound engineers.
This is like data compression stuff. Yeah. So I spent a summer in a lab working with a guy from India. He was a PhD student. I was going to work under him for the summer on a research project.
Right.
And I still remember him. He was a really nice guy, but he was from Indore. He was from a small province or something like in India called Indore. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how many how many people are from that area? He's like, oh, it's a small area, maybe like 40 million people. And I said, oh, shit. And the reason I asked him that was because...
The population of Canada in his region.
Yeah. And the reason I was asking him that was because he was the number one test taker on the IIT entrance exam from his state. Okay. And he was a PhD level student, and working with this guy, I got up front a and this lab was like Indian dudes, Pakistani dudes, you know, Persian, like Iranian dudes, and all PhD level. And I was like, holy shit, like the level of intent, like not intensity, okay, like I don't want to make it seem like these guys were just like,
but that's a lot of competition.
These guys are hardcore fucking, like they're deep end on the fucking math spectrum, okay, like these guys are, this guy scored number one out of a state of four, like you see what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Here like I am,
it's like being the top test taker in your country.
Yeah,
or like, yeah, if you live in like the American Southwest, like in the entire region.
Yeah. So here I am. I'm thinking I'm hot shit because I got a really good SAT score to this college. And I'm undergrad. And I've realized, like, this is JV shit.
This guy's like this guy's like Albert Einstein.
Exactly. From my perspective, this guy's a fucking genius, right? The way he's, like, showing me how to do the linear algebra and all this stuff. And I'm like, he's just doing this shit, like, on a board, right? Mm. And I'm sitting here thinking, look, I'm not a dumb guy. I scored a perfect on my SAT, and, you know, I'm like in the American track. I'm like, you know, okay.
Yeah, you're up there. Yeah, you're top tier.
This guy is a middling PhD guy, right? Like, we're at University of Maryland. This is not MIT. This guy's a middling guy. I heard after he got his PhD, he went to go work for Lucent for $45,000 a year.
What?
Yeah. And I was making more than that at some bullshit Michael Saylor company, you know, the Bitcoin guy. And I was making like a quite a bit more than that. I was making like 70K working for fucking a con artist. Like
I was making more than him at my first corporate job.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You see what I'm saying? And he went to work for some bullshit company like Lucent, which went bust. But he was like one of the smartest dudes I've ever met. And you will never hear his name again. I don't know what he's up to. But there's way more of that in the pipeline. And that's when I first got my taste of like true global competition. I was like, you really got to think, like, I feel like to this day, Silicon Valley has a face that's more like roughly white guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I feel like I don't really spend time there. I don't know much about it, but I feel like if you just pierce that veil a little bit, you will see like
these guys are not online like that. They're not
working.
Like exactly.
You're publishing papers.
You go on social media or LinkedIn or whatever, and it's a bunch of bland white guys in fucking polo shirts talking shit. Well, not polo shirts anymore. It's usually like white t-shirts and jeans, but like it's a bunch of white guys like talking shit about AI.
Yeah,
but they're not. That's not the workforce. The workforce is silent.
Shut the fuck up, dude. You know what I mean. Yeah. Yeah. There's the last episode or one of the recent Tucker Carlson interviews is with the mother of an ex OpenAI guy, Indian, and her son was a, like, they go through his list of fucking accomplishments, and it's similar to what I'm explaining to you about the guy that I was working with, won this award, everything, presented research here. I mean, a fucking genius, like a genius. No, not even joking when I'm using that. We overuse that term. Like, these guys are legit geniuses.
Yeah, right? we use that term for like authors and athletes and entertainers.
Yeah.
But yeah, we don't really have a concept of what a genius is because we're just too stupid to perceive it.
Yeah, exactly. But when you have to work with one of them, you kind of get it because you're like, I don't know what is going on with this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just like shit's coming out of his head. But like, this guy was a legit genius. And then the mother is putting forth the case that OpenAI was harassing him because he wanted to blow the whistle on him, and then they ended up killing him.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah, the story was that he committed suicide, but nobody thinks he committed suicide.
No, the mom's like, dude, he just came back from vacation. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
He was trying to blow the whistle on some of their practices. But Yeah, no, dude, I swear to God, I think that H-1B, the reason they're pushing so hard on it is, like, I still think, like, we have a very distorted notion of what the tech sector in America really looks like, because there's still a Sam Altman face to it. You know, there's still, like, a white VC guy face to it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, we have no idea the amount of international talent that we've sucked up from around the world, you know, and people are always like, India, it's not just India, dude, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, every country that produces top talent, be it.
It's, yeah, it's Nigeria. It's,
yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, it's the Philippines, it's in Indonesia, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, it is China, but also not, because China has been barely successful at hiring back. So, you know, when students end up studying abroad, whether it's at, you know, a top tier school in the UK or an Ivy League in the United States, they'll get some working experience in the West and then get hired back to China. So they have been fairly successful at that. I forget what the name of that program was that they launched. But you're right. Like they're and the thing is, I don't think that it's necessarily creating a brain drain in those other countries, because there's still enough available talent to build their own tech industries. At the same time, you're right, it pulls people out, like, rather than being able to further develop within their own countries, they end up coming over to the United States or Canada, because we have very similar programs, working for peanuts, burning themselves out, and then oftentimes not being able to qualify for permanent residency. And then either getting sent back home or just staying illegally. It's an awful system, but the only purpose of it is basically just to churn employees. They don't care about these people.
Yeah.
So when you talk to people who are ostensibly on the left about this shit, they talk about the issue as if the people that are being exploited, the people that are on these H-1B visas, they think about them as refugees. Like, anybody that comes to the United States from pretty much anywhere is a refugee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, everybody, you know, got trafficked across the Rio Grande by some Mexican coyotes. That's how they got here.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, people spent a lot of money because they had the money available to immigrate to the U.S. And they did exactly what they came here to do, which was to work, gain experience, and possibly get themselves permanent residency. But these aren't, you know, the tired, the poor, the hungry. These are oftentimes the upper middle class and the upper class within their societies.
Yeah,
it's just a competition among the ruling class internationally.
Yeah, it's not like desperately poor kids who suddenly score great numbers on these ridiculously difficult exams. I mean, you've got to get
right. Prepped. Yeah, they think of.
I'm not
like
saying schools that they're born rich per se, but they're not.
A lot of them are.
But what I'm saying is that
large palatial homes and, you know, domestic servants, oftentimes who are not paid, like they're just straight up slaves. You know, they have drivers, they have household staff. Like they're not poor a lot of the time.
Even if they were, in my opinion, it's like, I don't know. The way I see it is kind of like, a lot of them don't know what they're getting into when they come here, and they get fucking exploited to shit over here. And then I don't agree that these countries aren't suffering from brain drain. I think brain drain is a major problem for a lot of these countries, in my opinion.
Well, here's the thing. India has actually reversed its brain drain. That's why I say that. Right, like they've actually like brought talent back to India. That's developed their own tech industry. I mean, they do have a fairly large tech industry.
China was struggling. I have friends that were trying to do recruiting on behalf of Chinese companies, and they were like,
"Yeah,
it's tough. It's tough to convince top talent.
It's hard to compete with the wages.
Yeah, it's really hard." You know, yeah. I mean, it's not just wages. It's also do you actually want to live in China? It wasn't until like fairly recently where people were like, yeah, maybe. I think maybe it's livable now.
It's time to go back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because you know, the tier one and tier two cities are just like they're pretty
sweet looking.
You've seen the videos from Jiahongshu, and you know, they're it's like living in the future over there. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't very long ago where I thought they looked like shit. I mean, I posted this picture on Twitter from me of me in Shanghai in 2004. And all the lights were out at night. Like people were, and there were like dudes just walking down this, like groups of dudes just in boxer shorts walking down in August, smoking, you know. And people were like, no, people were legit like,
yeah.
People were legit like, dude, that's not 2004 at all. And yeah, I had to post the metadata from the
I call that Beijing core. Where like the guys will just like walk out in their fucking boxers, or they'll like they'll have their button down shirts just fucking wide open with their bellies hanging out and shit.
Yeah.
Just greasy.
Beijing air conditioner.
I love it.
Yeah. I'm curious if it's still like that. If it's not, I'm going to miss that aspect of China.
As far as I know, not really. But okay. Yeah, whatever. I mean, again, like I don't have any firsthand experience. I have people that I talk to.
I hope they keep it gritty over there.
I do too.
You know what I mean? It's cool with all this Xiaohongshu shit, but it's kind of like, I hope they keep it gritty, dude.
I don't like when people put on appearances to impress foreigners. Yeah. I don't like that. Just be yourself.
Yeah. Like I like the Hanfu shit and all the like the op, you know, all that stuff. It's like okay, I can't look at that too much. You know what I mean? I don't want to see that.
Let's I know. I scroll down my feed and it's all just beautiful people. Nothing but beautiful people and expensive cars.
I don't remember China being that way, dude.
No, you know? You're just seeing the cosmopolitan end of it, right?
Yeah.
But you know, I scroll through the feed on WeChat and it's just fucking farmers, which is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, I think, I think the younger generation is sort of like, I don't know, like cannot get out of this like image that's been constructed of cosmopolitanism. It's like there's this vision of like, I don't want to call it a social class, but it's a certain sort of like made it group and then a not made it group, and there's no vision for the not made it group. Like the not made it group is like your life is fucking over, dude. Like you're shit, you know, like you got no money, you got no prospect. Yeah. It's the incel bucket.
Yeah.
And there's
a lot of workers, as far as I understand it, you know, for a lot of workers over the age of like 35, 40, that's kind of what it's like. Like if you didn't make it, you're just not going to make it.
You're just a fucking loser.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's and there's no pride in being a loser. That there's no loser pride in America. You know what I mean? Like in the 80s, they were trying to instill a sense of like loser pride. You know, where you know it was like, hey,
you're supposed to be a loser, but you're like Al Bundy, who was a cool loser. Yeah,
yeah, you're supposed to band together. You know, like in fucking Stripes or something. You know, you're supposed to band together and beat the rich kids or something. You know, but not even a sense of that anymore. And
no, everything is. It's a. I don't know if you've ever read this this essay. It's called "Everyone's Beautiful and No One's Horny." That is like. And the essay writer, she was just talking about like in the films where everyone is just like just devastatingly attractive, you know, sculpted muscle, toned abs, you know, huge boobs. Like everybody just looks like runway models, and yet there's no sex in movies, or at least there, you know, sex in movies has been like drastically toned down. Some of the kind of shit that you and I would see like in the 1980s and 90s, right?
Yeah,
it's not really there anymore. The Disneyfication of film has caused that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's had a ripple effect across America, but especially post-COVID, where everybody's obligation is to make themselves as aesthetically pleasing as possible, but also sand off their rough edges. We're not allowed to be ourselves anymore. We're always putting on a performance as if our front-facing camera is on at all times.
Yeah, and I feel like I feel like the look for a lot of women online these days is very androidish and a little bit freaky. It's a little bit plastic.
Kim Kardashian. Unfortunately, Kim Kardashian and Kendall Jenner kind of set the tone, and it's been the same ever since. We're just never going to be escape the doom loop of like 2014 to 2020. We keep repeating it over and over and over again. And unfortunately, I actually think that.
Yeah, things haven't really changed, right?
Since the advent of probably like, people have always kind of put a notch in a certain time period where things stopped evolving. I think it was with the advent of the iPhone. I think probably around the iPhone 3 when it was. I mean, it was fairly fast that you could actually like do live streaming off of it. Mm-hmm. When people were able to use their phones and broadcast themselves to the world, it became like a portable broadcast device. I think right around then, that's when culture ended up freezing.
There's no 2000s look, right?
No.
Like, I can't think of, like, a... There's no, like, feel to the 2000s or the 2010s. And holy fuck, we're in the mid-2020s now.
Yeah.
If it was 2000...
There was a feel to the 2000s, but it was kind of a hangover from the late 1990s. Because, you know, what was the large event in the early 2000s that ended up causing culture to pause and engage in a slow reset was 9/11. So from about 1996 to 2008, there wasn't really a whole lot of forward development in terms of aesthetics and culture. But right around 2008, 2009, that's when shit, like, we just launched ourselves into a different era where all of us were basically trying to be as aesthetically pleasing to each other as possible, but also as inoffensive to each other as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's I think, what we're experiencing right now politically is the long pent-up backlash to all that. People are very sick and fucking tired of having to manage their images, their politics, their language, their identity, their culture, as if we're living, like, society is one gigantic HR department, and we're always being watched. I think right now, you know, with all the chud shit you're seeing, all the return of slurs and nasty language, being open about it, just playing around with and sharing Nazi memes, and calling people slurs online openly with our names and faces attached to the profiles that we're using to do that. I think this is all very much a backlash to that conformist era from about 2008 to 2024. Or 22. Yeah. I'd say 22, because right around 2022, when the bottom ended up falling out of the tech market, these massive layoffs happened, interest rates rise, Russia and Ukraine are engaged in a hot war. I think that was kind of what set the stage for everything. And ever since then, it's just been a slow and steady buildup until the return of the Trump presidency. Because what ended up happening was people just reverted to the only playbook they knew how to go to, which was try to do Obama 2008 all over again, and it doesn't fucking work. You can't sell people on hope when there's nothing to generate it. You don't have the financial backing anymore. You don't have you don't have debt financing upon which to draw to create jobs and programs out of nowhere. Right? Yeah. Like the cupboard's empty at this point, and people are just really sick and fucking tired of having to put on the best possible appearances to get nothing. And in fact, put on the best possible appearances and even lose it all. Lose your job, lose your social standing, your home, your family, whatever. There's just no reward anymore for being a good little boy or girl in front of the world.
Yeah, I think you know, there was this for a while. I feel like there was a reliable evolution in culture. Like, each decade would have its own sort of aesthetic, that as in contrast to the one prior. And that slowed down. I think we took it for granted that that would just happen. But it, looking back, I feel like it must be because there were significant, like, changes in the reality for people.
I mean, there kind of was and wasn't, right? No, I think we kind of, I mean, it depends on what decades you're talking about, but
I would say, like, from the 50s to the 60s was a big change.
Yeah. Yeah.
60s to 70s, not necessarily right at the cutoff, but I do think there were massive technological changes. There were massive economic changes, and that resulted in changes in the culture. Right. But I think the stagnancy of the culture recently, I think, is kind of like, maybe because
there's
an underlying material stagnancy.
People act as if the stock market is the great indicator of our overall economic health and how far we're progressing. It isn't. It's just a reflection of what people are willing to bet on the future. And unfortunately, that long bet has caught up with us. We were talking offline a little while ago, and you were saying that the Trump presidency could be the inverse of Gorbachev's presidency.
Oh, yeah.
Russia.
Yeah.
And I would say, in what we've had from 2008 to now, and I think what Joe Biden was highly emblematic of, was an inverse to the Brezhnev stagnancy.
Yeah, the great stagnancy is what Gorbachev called it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly where we've been. Even though it looks like on paper, it looks like we've come forward by leaps and bounds. When you have like the Will Stansels and Noah Smiths of the world, the Matt Iglesiases, that will look at what the bottom percentile of Americans earn on an annual basis. And they'll say, well, since 2020, they're earning an extra $2,500, I believe it was. And it's like, yes and no. That's actually incredibly misleading. Because that would assume, that would be to assume that a person who was either unemployed and receiving benefits or was just on the lowest end of the income ladder as somebody who was a salaried or waged worker, that they were earning, at the time, I believe it was around like 12,000 and change in 2020. Now it's closer to 16,000. They say, well, they're better off than they were before, to which I say, fuck you, you lying piece of shit. Because you had in the year 2022, and since then, millions of Americans hurtled down from comfortable middle-class lifestyles into the lowest end of the economic bracket, lowest end of the income bracket. So all it means is that those people went from jobs that paid $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, and instead of getting paid only $12,000 to become, say, Uber drivers or be on unemployment or work at McDonald's or wherever they ended up, well, instead of making only $12,000, now they're making $16,000. And you want to say to them, well, hey, you're better off than you would have been in 2020, to which they're like, I can't pay my fucking bills. And this time 3 years ago, I had a house. Like, suck my dick.
Yeah, I think there's also, when you mentioned the stock market, that's a big part of it, because you're seeing these incremental gains at the bottom, which did happen, I think, mostly because of labor shortages and things like that. Mm. But, or for whatever reason, but I think it doesn't matter, because the stock market represents a huge growth in the wealth of the top percentiles, because they own all the fucking stock, right? So all of the capital appreciation that we see in the stock market, like, we go rah-rah about it as a nation, but it's like, dude, it's only the readership of the Wall Street Journal that really cares about that.
Exactly. Okay?
And in fact, regular people should care about it as a negative correlator, because it's like, the more the stock market goes up, the more those motherfuckers are getting ahead of you.
Left behind.
Right? Yeah. So here's the thing. The stock market is just numbers on a paper, right? So it's like their notional wealth is going way the fuck up. And what that means is that the total national wealth, if all of the United States wealth is a pie, all it means is like you went up by $3 an hour. They went up by
a net worth of like $30 trillion
in the stock. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Their slice of their portion of the pie got way bigger, and yours got way smaller.
Way smaller. Yeah, in proportion. Exactly.
In proportion. It's proportional. But yeah. Stancils and shit are going to lie, because they either don't know or they refuse to understand the concept of stock and flow. And it's like, okay,
that's the worst part. I never, you know how that there's that phrase, never attribute to malice that which can be explained by stupidity.
Yeah,
I've thrown that out the window. These people aren't stupid. They know exactly what the fuck they're doing.
I think he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, it is malice. He actually does know this, and he has been auditioning for the past several years for a job within the Democratic Party apparatus, just like Matt Iglesias has, by lying to people.
Yeah, professional gaslighters. That's what they are.
Yeah,
their job is to take people on the cusp, and appeal to their fucking their shitlib brain and say, no, guys, you're on the side of the Wall Street Journal. You have a $12,000 stock portfolio. You belong on our side. You know, that kind of shit.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, you don't, you're not one of them, but okay.
You're not one of the bros. Exactly. Like you can turn off CNBC. Like you're not going to make it up there with them.
This is why I think all of these like crypto bros are a problem. All of them think they're motherfucking, they're suddenly like the traders from Wall Street with their fucking Robin Hood app or whatever.
Yeah, they think they're Gordon Gekko.
Exactly. Right? With your little, and what are they trading? Fucking Trump coin and Doge? You know, like.
Literal fart coin. I saw it the other day. There's one called fart coin. I'm like, I'm done. I'm out of here.
they're like, hey, I'm gonna dump a little bit and I'm gonna rip their face off. And you look at their app, it's Robinhood with Fartcoin, and you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's turning everyone into, you know, this is my thing about the whole like the inverse Gorbachev thing is like, I think that we're like America is anti-communist, and I don't mean we're against communism. I'm saying I think we're the inverse of communism. So,
right.
To the extent that communism was supposed to be some worker paradise where nobody was a capitalist and everyone was a worker, we're the opposite. Everyone's a fucking capitalist. Nobody's a worker.
Nobody's a worker. Yep.
Yeah. Everyone's trading, making, you know, leveraging.
That's the thing that just annoys me about this. You know, when people talk about, when people call Kamala Harris supporters commie, and that everyone on the left, they just don't want to work because they saw a Reddit post called, what was it? Anti-work. Anti-work. Somebody posted on there, I do not dream of labor. And that's what they think that we're all like. And it's like, no, that's you guys.
Yeah.
You guys don't want to fucking work.
Yeah,
you think you're going to work just long enough to amass enough money that you can buy a thing. You can basically like make a futures bet on a particular thing. It used to be tangibles. Now it's no longer tangibles. It's just ideas of things.
And well, all you're doing is betting on other people's money.
Other people. Well, you're betting on how stupid other people are with their money.
You're just trying to take other people's money. That's all you're
exactly. Exactly. So. Yeah,
which, by the way, we're at an hour. Yeah. You it's a good spot to transition to. I don't know what your time is like, but sometimes we do like a bonus as well.
Okay,
you want to do that?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Well. All right. So if you want to hear, let's talk about this inverse. I want to talk about this inverse shit and this sort of like anti inverse, upside down post capitalist anti communism that we're living in or whatever. I want to run this by you. But if you want to get access to bonus pods and stuff, go to patreon.com/planetmag. All right.